The final images of Damien Hurd's life show the college wrestler pumping gas at 1:30 a.m. before disappearing into the dark, cold night in Gunnison, Colorado. Police say that was the act of a deliberate, disturbed individual. But in the days that followed, multiple witnesses would come forward with information that challenged the narrative of suicide. Was Damien so desperate that he ended his own life? Or were there other forces at play that explain his demise? Join me as we try to discover what happened to Damien Hurd and who, if anyone, is responsible. From Cold Case Productions, this is Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Hurd, Episode 6, Eyewitnesses. I'm your host, Claire Santamaw. Thanks for listening. In this episode, we'll explore new eyewitness reports that surfaced after Damien's disappearance and the discovery of his body. The first eyewitness who entered into the investigation was Linda Nienhauser, a hiker and City of Gunnison employee, whose report we covered in detail in Episode 5. But there are more witnesses who came forward to offer their help, and the information they shared with law enforcement shed a surprising new light on the days following Damien's death. Let's start with wrestler Francisco Marquez. In an interview with Detective Grace Cowan a month after Damien's death, Francisco says he knows of two eyewitnesses who haven't spoken to police yet.
I know that two of the kids on my wrestling team saw him. They said that they saw him driving. They said that he was, like, speeding out of Gunnison.
Speeding? Who told you that?
Travis Bradford and Colin McNally.
I first told you about this sighting in Episode 3, Missing, because it occurred on Monday, March 31st, 2014, 2 days before Damien's body was found. But police didn't actually hear about it until almost 2 months later. At this point, they'd already finished processing Damien's car and had even released several statements indicating no foul play was involved in the wrestler's disappearance and death. Detective Chris Danos tracked down Travis Bradford on the phone on May 14, 2014, a week after Francisco talked to police. Just to note that the audio quality of this recording is not great, but it's the only recording we have to work with, as police did not tape their conversation with Colin McNally.
Hey, the reason I'm calling is I was told on March 29th, or the early morning hours of March 30th, it had been a Saturday, Sunday, you were out longboarding with a guy named Colin?
Yes. Yeah, I probably was. He's my roommate. We longboard all the time.
Okay. I was told that you saw Damien Hurd speeding out of town on that occasion. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah. We were at Subway, and we thought we saw his Saturn going down to meet you.
In Gunnison, the Subway sandwich shop is on the corner of Iowa Street and Tamichi Avenue.
When were you at Subway?
I think it was Monday. I'm not 100% sure.
Despite being nearly 2 months after the event, and the fact that Detective Danos initially gave Travis the date as Saturday or Sunday, Travis said it was Monday when he saw Damien's Saturn SUV. This information is huge on multiple levels. One, it gets Damien's car off campus and leaving town. And two, the timing of it places Damien's car on the road on Monday afternoon, a day after his body was first spotted at Cabin Creek.
You thought it was Monday?
I think so.
Was it during the daytime?
Yeah, we were going there for dinner or lunch. I don't remember which one.
A curious feature of Damien's car stood out in Travis's memory.
You thought you saw his car leaving town?
Yeah, and then we saw, like, the license plate was tilted a little, like, kind of crooked, like a screw was out.
Oh, okay.
As I first discussed in Episode 3, I found the description of Damien's license plate to be pretty interesting. But Detective Danos glosses right over that detail and moves on to his next question.
Did you see who was driving the car?
Yeah, to say we couldn't tell who it was driving.
If it's Monday afternoon, one thing is certain. Damien Hurd isn't driving that vehicle. He's already dead. And what about his license plate? Travis said it was hanging by one screw.
There was no other black Saturn SUVs in the town that we were aware of, and it had Texas license plates on it, so it was a dead giveaway that it was his vehicle.
When I heard about the missing screw, it made me think of other criminal cases where suspects have removed or altered license plates to avoid detection by law enforcement. If there was foul play involved in Damien's death, it makes sense that the perpetrators would try to remove his out-of-state plates. Unfortunately, Detective Danos didn't ask Travis if he remembered the color of the crooked license plate or anything else about it. The standard Colorado plate with the green mountain landscape is in stark contrast to the Texas plates that Damien had, which were blue and red. When police find Damien's car on Wednesday, the Texas plates are firmly affixed with all the screws in place. Travis goes on to tell the detective that Damien's car was headed straight down the road that leads to Cabin Creek.
Where was the car headed?
Just down from Ichi. I don't really know.
Which direction?
Going toward the McDonald's, I think.
Okay.
McDonald's is located about a half a mile east from Subway on Tamichi Avenue. Tamichi turns into Highway 50, which runs east and intersects with Bureau of Land Management Road 3107 at the Cabin Creek turnoff, the road where Damien's car was found.
Did you see if there's anybody in the car?
No, we couldn't tell. It went by real fast.
As we first discussed in Episode 3, Damien drove a black 2004 Saturn View, an SUV that was relatively unique. Saturn stopped making cars in 2009, so there weren't many of them on the road in general, and statements from Damien's friends to police indicated that they knew Damien drove a Saturn SUV, and they didn't know of anyone else on campus with that kind of car. Both Travis and Colin told police they recognized the car speeding east on Tamichi Avenue as Damien's SUV. Damien's father, Gary Hurd, thinks the details are significant.
They reported to the police, both of them reported to the police, that they seen Damien's vehicle driving out of town toward the scene at a higher rate of speed, and they also said that the license plate was hanging crooked on it.
In Colin's interview with police, which again wasn't recorded, he appears to tell virtually the same story as Travis, with a few more details. According to the written police report, Colin says he and Travis went to Subway between 5 and 6 p.m. on Monday, March 31st, after lifting weights. Colin also describes Damien's car as speeding east on Tamichi Avenue, and he notes the crooked license plate that appeared to be hanging by one screw. It's a consistent story told by three different people, two direct witnesses, Colin and Travis, and Frankie Marquez, who remembers a contemporaneous account of the sighting. It's worth noting here that there was a small bag of hand tools and a brand new screwdriver set found in Damien's car after his death. The screwdriver set was mostly still packaged and sitting on the floorboard of the front passenger side of Damien's car, not far from his disassembled cell phone. The tool bag appeared to be older and was found lying on the back seat. Gary Hurd told police he did not recognize the tool bag or remember it as something that Damien kept in his car. Police finished processing Damien's vehicle on April 8th. They didn't hear a report that Damien's license plate was seen hanging by one screw until more than a month later, when they spoke to Travis Bradford on May 14th and Colin McNally on May 30th. There is no record of the screwdriver set, tool bag, or license plate being fingerprinted or the license plate ever being checked for any kind of repairs. Hearing this information after the fact, when we know the reality of Damien's suspicious death, it's hard to believe Travis and Colin didn't immediately share it with police. But to be fair, when the guys believed they saw Damien Saturn on Monday, he wasn't even officially a missing person yet. If you recall, Monday was also the day that Damien's student ID was reportedly used in the cafeteria, and the day that his attendance was recorded in two classes via email confirmation from his professors. Monday was either a day with a flurry of false information, or a day filled with activities meant to conceal Damien's true location.
It's not evidence or proof that there was foul play.
Yeah.
But it is consistent inconsistencies that raise questions of why. Why? How did this happen?
The truth is, if on Monday Damien's car really was traveling east on Tamichi Avenue, he wasn't the one driving it. Who could have been behind the wheel? And what would that say about the circumstances of Damien's death?
I don't know how you answer all those things without just saying, yeah, those are unanswerable things, but it's not evidence of murder.
Yeah.
It's not evidence of foul play. I understand that logic. I totally understand it. But I think, in my little pea brain, I'm just thinking, okay, well, you have all these inconsistencies. You know, at some point, they pile up so heavy, they definitely don't point towards suicide. They don't support the story that the police portrayed in their report.
There's another detail that points to the possibility of someone other than Damien driving his SUV. When detectives spotted Damien's vehicle, they noted that the driver's seat was reclined back. At 5 feet 7 inches tall, Damien had to sit relatively close to the steering wheel to drive.
I really don't know why it would have been reclined back, other than for a bigger person to drive the vehicle. He never rode around with the seat reclined back. It was always almost in a straight up and down position.
After Gunnison police returned Damien's car to his father, he conducted an experiment on the position of the driver's seat.
Did you at some point have someone who's about Damien's height sit in that seat with it reclined to see if they could reach the gas pedals?
That is correct. And it would not have been a comfortable position for that person to drive the vehicle. Possible, yes. But highly unlikely that that's the adjustment that you would have arranged, being Damien's size, to drive the car comfortably.
It appears police did not consider a connection between Damien's seat being reclined to accommodate a taller driver and the statements of Travis Bradford and Colin McNally about someone driving Damien's SUV after he was dead, despite the fact that their sighting of Damien's car was consistent with the route from campus to the death scene at Cabin Creek. I reached out to Travis Bradford and Colin McNally for an interview in 2020, but they did not respond to my requests. I did, however, reach Colin McNally's father in the process of trying to locate his son.
Hello?
Hi, is this Colin?
No.
Oh, okay. I think I have the wrong number.
You got the right number, probably. This is his father.
I thought I was calling Colin's cell phone, but I actually called his childhood home in Tennessee. I explained that I was a journalist working on a podcast about the life and death of Damien Hurd. Colin's dad remembered the young wrestler instantly.
I went to his service out there.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry. I know it was a really tragic situation. And
you're doing a podcast on the death of him?
I am, yes, sir.
For whom?
It's for a company called Cold Case Productions.
Cold Case, huh?
Yeah.
How about that?
How about
you're trying to dig it up again, huh?
Well, you know, I feel like there are a lot of questions that were never answered, and I hope that, you know, I can bring some closure to the case. I know that from the people that I've reached out to, you know, it's never really that far from their minds. People still think about Damien and still wonder, you know, still have questions, and so I've been going through it.
You don't think it was a suicide?
I told Mr. McNally that I was looking at all avenues in Damien's case, including the conclusion reached by police that it was a suicide.
Well, Colin's an adult, so I'll give you his cell phone number, and you can talk to him, and he can decide whether he wants to talk to you or not.
Of course. I appreciate that so much.
I took down the number and called Colin straight away.
You've reached the phone of Colin McNally.
At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hi, Colin. My name is Claire Sanema, and I'm a journalist working on a podcast about the life and death of Damien Hurd. I know that's a blast from the past, and I hope you don't mind me contacting you. But I came across your name, and I was hoping you might consider talking.
Colin has never responded to my voicemail. In the absence of any resolution to the sightings of Damien's car on Monday, March 31st, Gary Hurd has developed his own theory about how his son ended up at Cabin Creek.
I think that Damien was incapacitated when he got there. I think that he went back to that house after getting gas. I think that we've got a couple of statements to back that up, and he got really bad when he went back.
Gary believes that the sighting of Damien's car, the front seat being reclined, and the reports of license plate tampering all point to someone else driving Damien's vehicle after his death. If you can believe it, there's even another eyewitness who calls in a tip in Damien's case, and his statement fits with the timeline of Damien's Saturn being moved from the Cabin Creek location between Sunday afternoon, when Linda Nienhauser saw it, and Monday evening, when Colin and Travis did.
Detective Chris Danos, Friday, May 2nd, 2:45 p.m. I'm returning a call to a Matt Marvel.
Just to note that there's radio music in the background throughout this call. For the sake of authenticity, I left it in.
The message I have is he has information in regards to the Damien Hurd death investigation.
Hello?
Is this Matt?
Yeah, it is.
Matt Marvel is a local Gunnison resident who called in a tip to the police department about a month after Damien's body was found.
What do you have information regarding?
Well, it's about the case out there on Cabin Creek.
Okay.
I was having a conversation with my brother-in-law the other day, and I remembered that I'd taken a drive on Monday, the 31st of March.
Okay.
And I pulled into the Cabin Creek turnoff, and I witnessed two vehicles in that parking lot. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning.
What two vehicles did you see sitting in the parking lot?
There was a sedan that was parked to the left of the gate, and it was perpendicular to the fence. And then there was either a, I don't really remember if it was a pickup with a shell or some sort of SUV, and it was parked to the right side of the road, parallel with the fence.
Because it's been a while since most of us were in geometry class, perpendicular is a relationship between two objects that meet at a 90-degree angle. In this case, Matt says the sedan was perpendicular to the fence and to the left of the gate. And the second vehicle, either a pickup truck with a camper shell or an SUV, was parked parallel, meaning in line with, the fence, on the right side of the road. Matt says he pulled off at the Cabin Creek turnoff to let a couple cars pass him while sightseeing in the mountains about 10 a.m. on Monday. He took a cursory glance at the vehicles before pulling back onto the highway and continuing on his way. But his description presents a problem for the police theory of the case. In short, dead people don't move cars. And the facts show that Damien was dead by Sunday afternoon when Linda Nienhauser went for her hike. Matt's description of the vehicles is notable because he said the only car that might have been an SUV was parked parallel to the fence on the right side of the road. When police found Damien's Saturn SUV on Wednesday, April 2nd, it was parked on the left side of the road. And interestingly enough, Matt's description of a second vehicle included a truck with a shell, which is the same kind of vehicle that Linda reported seeing on Sunday. Detective Danos presses the tipster on his memory.
Where was the front of the SUV?
The SUV was pointing to the east, so it was parallel with the fence, and it was to the right of the gate.
What color was the vehicle that you described being to the left of the gate or the fence?
You know, I just remember it was a dark-colored vehicle, and it was either, you know, a two-door or four-door sedan.
The position of this sedan most closely aligns with the position that Damien's black SUV was found in, but it's hard to imagine mistaking an SUV for a two- or four-door sedan. And the other vehicle that Matt described as either a truck with a shell or an SUV was parked on the right side of the road, and he thinks it was maroon.
A truck with a topper or an SUV, what color was it?
You know, if I had to say, it seems like it was like a maroon color, but I really don't know for sure.
The entire conversation with Matt Marvel lasted only 7 minutes. And it doesn't appear that police contacted him again, or asked him to meet at the scene to better understand his description. Detective Danos never asked Matt about the license plates on the vehicles, such as if he noticed an out-of-state plate on either of the vehicles, or if he remembered a breast cancer awareness license plate, like Linda Nienhauser had mentioned. Detective Danos spoke with Matt Marvel on May 2nd. Later that month, Travis Bradford and Colin McNally shared their vehicle sighting with police. If all three reports are considered valid, they would support a theory that someone moved Damien's SUV on Sunday evening or Monday morning and was spotted returning it in haste down Tamichi Avenue. This would explain why Matt didn't see Damien's vehicle when he stopped by Cabin Creek on Monday morning. There's no evidence these statements were ever considered in connection with each other, except by this podcast. With the amount of detail that we covered about the party at the wrestler's house in previous episodes, you might think you already know everything there is to know about the events at North Taylor Street on that fateful Saturday night. But there's an entirely new thread to follow, one that first surfaced about a week after Damien's body was found. It revolves around the existence of an unusual item at the party.
It had some sort of mask that's supposed to make it hard to breathe when you run a high-altitude breathing mask or something.
That's Courtney Birch, one of the roommates at the wrestling house, describing the scene when she arrived back home around 1:30 in the morning. Courtney told Detective Danos that she saw Kyle Pyatt and Chris Nieto using the breathing mask in the front yard.
So Kyle was running up and down the street with that on, and then Chris left and Kyle came in and sat on the couch with me, and then Lauren and Zach and JT and Christian all left, and Kyle and I stayed up for probably another 30, 45 minutes just talking about the night.
At this point in the investigation, Detective Danos had already talked to Zach Shank and Kyle Pyatt, and neither one of them had mentioned the mask. But what about wrestler Chris Nieto? It appears Gunnison police never interviewed him at all. I reached out to Chris in February 2021 to request an interview for this podcast. He said, quote, "I'm not interested. Thank you for the offer." When Dano spoke with the other witnesses provided by Courtney, multiple people remembered the mask playing a role at the party sometime after 1:30 a.m.
Had some type of conditioning mask that he could put on and run around with.
I was screwing around with that when we were talking.
That's James Terry Pickard, who goes by JT.
I remember they were playing with the mask and them explaining how that trained them to breathe less or something.
You know, work with less oxygen.
Yeah.
Lauren Dolliffe also brought up the mask, unprompted, in her interview with Detective Danos.
Was it a fun party?
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. It was a little overwhelming at first.
What about it was overwhelming?
A lot of people. I'm slightly claustrophobic, so
I
kind of freak out when I go to parties. There's a lot of people. I didn't know a lot of them. I stayed in the back room and sat on couches and socialized with the people that I arrived with, and then it died down around 1:30-ish.
Okay.
And we sat in the front room with the owners of the house. I don't know.
Is Kyle there?
People that were. I don't remember if he was there. If he was I know who Kyle is, yes.
Okay.
If he was there, I think he was playing with someone's gas mask, but I wasn't paying attention to that.
There are several interesting points here. First, the existence of an oxygen deprivation mask at a party after which a freshman wrestler turns up dead of asphyxiation is worth noting. Second, Kyle never mentioned the mask at all to police in his interviews, but three different people did, and their stories line up with each other. What's more, Kyle told police he wasn't even at the wrestler's house at 1:30 a.m. when he was reportedly using the oxygen deprivation mask. Instead, Kyle says he was at a different party at Mountaineer Village apartment complex and didn't return home until 3 a.m. There's also no indication that police ever collected, or attempted to collect, the oxygen deprivation mask as potential evidence in Damien's death investigation.
Had Damien ever talked about using an oxygen deprivation mask while he was at college?
No.
That's Damien's father, Gary Hurd.
He left in June to go up there to live there in that altitude. So by the time wrestling season came around, he was already conditioned to it.
Damien's father was also a youth wrestling coach, So he talked to his son a lot about training techniques and different strategies. But an oxygen deprivation mask never came up.
To my knowledge, he never wore one.
And knowing what you know today, do you believe that that mask could have played a role in Damien's death?
I think it's possible. It's plausible, for sure. It would coincide with not getting enough oxygen. I lean more toward the rear naked choke that Kyle Pyatt had him in. The fact that he was dragging him through the house.
A rear naked choke is a well-known wrestling move applied to an opponent from behind. It's also called a sleeper hold and is often used in mixed martial arts matches to end a fight.
When other people at the wrestler's party was asking about Damien's whereabouts, they were being told by a couple of the wrestlers that they had put Damien to sleep, which is what a rear naked choke does.
We first heard this language from Western student Lacey Miller in her police interview on May 8th.
Kyle and Damien started arguing. They just took Damien to the laundry room just to calm them down and just put Damien to sleep, and that was it.
A rear naked choke will render you unconscious if applied properly. In about 7 to 8 seconds, you will go unconscious.
Eyewitnesses from the party described a variety of confrontations between Kyle Pyatt and Damien Hurt, and included everything from a shouting match to a physical altercation. The description that most closely aligns with Gary Hurd's theory comes from Morgan Lambert. She wasn't interviewed until July 9, 2014, 3 months after detectives had spoken with Kyle Pyatt.
I saw Pyatt take Damien into the laundry room.
When you said you saw Pyatt take him into the laundry room, what does that mean?
He had him in a headlock.
Morgan went on to describe a hold where Kyle Pyatt had his arm around Damien's neck, with Damien's back to him. In her view, which was from across the room at a crowded party, Morgan said the hold didn't appear, quote, super tight.
So Pyatt just had him, was holding him, and was just, like, trying to drag him through the party. He wasn't, like, holding him, like, super tight to the point where, like, he couldn't move.
Uh-huh.
It was just, like...
He had his arm around his shoulder type of thing?
Around his, like, neck-ish.
Around his neck? Okay.
In the videotape of Morgan's interview with police, she acts out the hold that she said she saw Kyle Pyatt put on Damien Hurd. Gary Hurd believes it's a rear naked choke.
If the hold is not removed, once the person goes unconscious, it could do several things. It can render the person dead. It can render the person in a vegetative state where they just don't wake back up. Their body is still breathing, the heart is still beating, but basically your brain dead. The brain has shut off from a lack of oxygen.
In his interviews with police, Kyle Pyatt denied physically hurting Damien or knowing anything in detail about what happened to him. The other wrestlers defended Kyle, their team captain, and said he would never hurt Damien, whether on purpose or on accident. Morgan Lambert told police she saw Damien after Kyle had him in a headlock, and she helped Damien lie down in a back room. When I reached out to Kyle in 2020 for this podcast, he told me that the last time he tried to talk to the media about what happened to Damien, his words got all twisted up and he looked like the bad guy. "I loved that kid," Kyle said. "It just really sucks." I continued to text with Kyle for the next week, but he ultimately decided against speaking with me, saying, "Thank you for the offer, but I'm going to respectfully decline. I'm sorry." Honestly, I feel for Kyle in this situation. He lost a close friend in a terrible tragedy, and now he's endured speculation that he was somehow involved. But I'm also a firm believer that sunshine is the best disinfectant, and I think the only way we can ever know what happened to Damien is to talk to as many people as possible who were with him the night he died. And while I recognize that's a painful thing to do, I don't think anyone can move on until all the questions are addressed out in the open. If you're listening to this podcast, Kyle, my offer to speak with you still stands. On the next episode of Final Days on Earth, the life and death of Damien Hurd.
Anybody else say anything to you about he got crazy again and they had to, not like, I'm not saying beat him down or anything, but restrain him maybe is a better word?
We'll reconstruct the timeline of key events from Saturday, the night of the party, until Wednesday morning, when Damien's body is discovered.
It just doesn't make sense for him to go, like, fill up his car right before people, like, last saw him, and it's weird.
Final Days on Earth is recorded in Dallas, Texas for Cold Case Productions in partnership with Podcast One and Live by Live. Each episode is written, reported, and produced by me, Claire Sanimal. Original theme music composed and performed by Riley Simmons. Songs licensed from PremiumBeat.com are Bending Truth and A Thin Line. Editorial consultant is Lucy Scott of LucyMedia.com. Additional production help from Amber Robinson, Janice Sue, and Elise Weber. Executive producers are Sharon Richards and me, Claire Sanimal. Special thanks to Gary Hurd and Colin McNally's dad for speaking to me in this episode. Tune in next week as we continue our search to understand what happened to Damien Hurd and who, if anyone, is responsible.